Hi, listeners. This is a quick thank you for listening and for your ongoing support. If you're enjoying the program, please consider clicking the follow or subscribe button if you haven't done so already. It really helps us out. There's no better way to support us than doing that or sharing the show with a friend, colleague, family member, or any new or expecting parent in your life. It's totally appreciated. On with the show. Hi, I'm Sarah Trott, and welcome to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm a new mama, and this podcast is all about postpartum care for the first few months following birth, the time period also known as the fourth trimester. My postpartum doula, Esther Gallagher, is my co-host. She's a mother, grandmother, perinatal educator, birth and postpartum care provider. Fourth trimester care, our topic, is about the practical, emotional, and social support parents and baby require. And importantly, it helps set the tone for the continuing journey of parenting. Hi, and welcome back to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm Sarah Trott, and I am here today with a special guest who is a repeat guest because she is absolutely 100% a great authority on the topic we have today, which is sleep, baby sleep, family sleep. And we are going to cover the top 10 sleep training questions and answers today. My guest is a PhD sleep consultant, and she is, like I said, someone who's been on the program before. Her name is Angelique Millette, and I'm going to introduce her properly for anyone who hasn't heard any of her previous episodes in a moment. Before I do, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we have a website, which is fourthtrimesterpodcast.com. Please go there and sign up for our newsletter if you have not yet done so. You can have information and resources delivered directly to your inbox. You can also follow us on Instagram and certainly hit follow or subscribe anywhere you listen to your podcast so that you can be alerted every time we release a new episode. So I want to also mention a little bit about Angelique's background now. So like I said, she's a returning guest. She has been a guest for some of our top episodes, our sleep training episode, another one dedicated to the no or low cry sleep method, as well as a brilliant episode on transitioning your baby to their own room, which is so helpful for anyone who's planning that or going through that at the moment. And like I said, this episode is going to be answering the top 10 baby sleep questions and answers. But if you want to go back and deep dive on one of those specific topics I just mentioned, go back and listen to one of those prior episodes. And we'll link the links to all of those prior episodes in the show notes here to make that really easy to find. Okay, so introducing Angelique. Dr. Angelique Millette has such a wealth of experience, as I mentioned, in baby sleep solutions. She's been working in the space for over 25 years. She's helped more than 15,000 families, including my own, for which I'm incredibly grateful. She has a really diverse background, and her training includes child play and art and nature therapies and child psychology. And she's also a mom herself. And personally speaking, from my own experience working with her, and just in general, like working with a sleep consultant, what it does, what it did for me was gave me a lot of confidence and reassurance, honestly, that the way we were working to meet our family sleep goals were in line with what was developmentally appropriate and safe and loving for my baby, which was the thing that I was, I think, a little bit most stressed out about throughout the whole thing, as well as just getting enough sleep. So sleep is such a big topic. We're really excited to bring you back, Angelique, onto the Fourth Trimester Podcast. Welcome back.
Thank you, Sarah. It is so great to see you again. It's great to be back speaking with parents about sleep. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. Oh my goodness. When you and I were talking about doing this episode, there were so many potential questions that we thought would be perfect for this top 10 list. We had a hard time narrowing it down, but we really think that we honed in and nailed these top questions that people just really are constantly asking you. And so I'm really excited to go through them, but you work with so many families. When families come to you, what's the feeling in the room typically?
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you asked that. I would say 25 years of working with families, it's the most overwhelm and burnout I've ever seen in parents. Pandemic did us no favors, and we're in this post-pandemic era, and things changed really fast. They accelerated quickly, and parents are really overwhelmed. There was a great study that just came out that, you know, confirmed this. It's no surprise. We all feel it as parents. And we're certainly seeing in the sleep work, we're seeing parents waiting too long to reach out for sleep support. Way too long. Everybody, don't wait. I think what's happening is they're just trying to juggle everything. And so adding on one more thing, like sleep support, feels like too much. And by the time they get to me, they're pretty worn out. Their marriages are struggling. Their health is struggling. Their relationship with their child is struggling. And I think a big take home that, as we talk today, I want everybody to think about your unique family dynamics, your sleep situation, your health, the health of your family. And you want to be asking yourselves this question, are we getting our sleep needs met? And we have a tendency as parents to kind of dig in and just adjust to the new normal, which might be that we're waking up at night with a toddler or a baby that is feeding more times than they need to at night. We just sort of say, this is what I need to do. But months and months of that can be debilitating for that family. So if that's your family and you're listening today, reach out. I offer a free 15-minute consult just to give you some tips, just to give you some hope. You're not alone. So that's my preach for the day, that you're not alone. Reach out and get some help.
Perfect. I love that. That's such a great way to open it up too, in the context of asking for help, because we talk a lot about that on the fourth trimester. It extends to all kinds of self-care and needs for the family and the supporting community. There's no shame in reaching out for help. So I really appreciate that opener.
Sure.
Yeah. So the top 10 questions, the first one that we came up with was something that I think comes up for you over and over again, which is the age-old question, when will my baby sleep through the night? Or put another way, how can I get my baby to sleep from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m.?
Ooh, I love this question. Okay, so folks that are listening in today, you are going to hear me debunk a lot of myths about pediatric sleep. So strap in, hang tight. The most popular sleep book out there is a sleep book that's called 12 Hours at 12 Weeks. Can you imagine? So that's 12 hours of sleep, 7 to 7, no feeding at 12 weeks of age. And then, of course, the suggestion is to limit to just 4 feeds during the day. There is no science behind that. And there is no science that supports 12 hours of sleep or 7 to 7. Of course, there's a lot of good marketing, social media, sleep consultants that say that's the holy grail. But the science is 10 to 12 hours of sleep at night. It's variable. And we even have some outliers around that, some that sleep 9.5 hours, some that sleep 13 hours. So when we're looking at sleeping through the night, the science shows that sleeping through the night is sleeping 5 to 8 hours by 5 to 6 months of age, and then having a feed and then going back to sleep. So for a lot of the 5 to 6 month olds, they're still feeding at night. It's pretty typical. So much so that some of the original sleep books, like Wise Blue's book, some of the original folks that were writing their sleep books, they've come back and said that babies need a feed at night that first year. I mean, it really is like a dramatic recall of this old, outdated paradigm that it's 12 hours at night, no feeds. And then just to add in more of debunking the myths, it was at 14 pounds, they can all sleep through the night. No science, not a lick of science that supports that. It was just a number that was made up and thrown out there. So, at least all this guilt as parents if our 4-month-old is feeding at night, not sleeping 12 hours. So I'm here to debunk myths and correct that. So as parents, we're going, oh, okay, my baby's normal. They need to feed at night. So we're looking for usually for a 4 to 6 month old, it's anywhere from 0 to 2 feeds at night. And for some of them, they might even feed 2 to 3 times at night because of transfer of milk issues or some issues with their weight gain. It's variable. You're looking at your unique baby. For most, the average is sleeping 5 to 8 hours before night feed, and that's somewhere around 5, 6, 7 months of age.
My babies were only sleeping probably, gosh, especially very early on in the fourth trimester, like maybe an hour. And then that, like, over time grew to a little bit longer, a little bit longer. But the expectation should be what you're saying. There's lots of wakefulness in between sleep. So babies do sleep the majority of the time, especially when they're really little, right? But it's not uninterrupted sleep. It is interrupted sleep. They're interrupting themselves because they're developing their brain. They're developing their body and they need to eat. That's what you're saying, is that that's where the science is. That's actually perfectly normal. And that's what we should be expecting, particularly in the first 6 months and then potentially the first year.
Their sleep is consolidating and they're waking every 90 minutes to 2 hours a night. My phone rings because of the babies that wake up every 90 minutes to 2 hours and they need some help to get back to sleep. And they may not be able to link up their sleep cycles. They did a really great experiment, Sarah. I think this is so important to share with parents. They put video cameras in the rooms of thousands of babies. They had the camp of parents that said, my baby never wakes up at night. They're great sleepers. We all know those parents, right? We might've been one. And then they had the other parents that said, I don't get what's going on. My baby wakes up and calls out at night. They're waking up. Guess what? The video recorded every one of those babies woke up at night. To your point, they're learning to consolidate and link up sleep cycles through the night the first 3 years. But the ones that weren't vocalizing or signaling in between the sleep cycles, their parents said they're just sleeping through the night. But in fact, they were waking up just like their peers were waking up. They just were quietly waking. They weren't signaling. It's a really important point, and you're making it, Sarah, which is that their sleep is organizing and consolidating, in particular, the first 1 to 2 years. And it's normal for them to call out and wake up.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. So is there any point in quote-unquote sleep training during that first 6 months?
I think it's a fair question. So the newborn sleep, we call it naps, because it's 75% of it is similar to REM sleep. They're just having these shorter cycles, but by 3 to 4 months, their sleep starts to look like our sleep. They start to have about 35-40% of their sleep is REM sleep. And then by 8 to 12 months, it totally looks like our sleep. So I would say good time to start sleep training. The circadian rhythm is not fully developed at birth. Sorry, folks. It's not the baby's fault. Their day cycles and night cycles don't organize until about 2, 3, 4 months of age. And it's exposure to sunlight that organizes it. Same for us. So those first months as newborns, they don't have a fully formed circadian rhythm. They don't have fully formed day night cycle. So there's no point in sleep training until they're about 4 to 6 months. That's when we officially start. Because by then the circadian rhythm's organized. By the way, you'll know that your baby's circadian rhythm's organized because they stop pooping at night, like us. If we were up at night pooping, the world would be very different. But we don't. And that's because we have a day-night cycle. That's your sign that your newborn cycle, their biological clock is like yours now. It's starting to be like yours. So you've got this really wonderful time right around 14 to 18 weeks, which coincidentally is the 4 month sleep regression when their sleep starts to disorganize. It's the first window of opportunity when I know that I have a legitimate sleep issue with the baby that needs to be fixed. Prior to that, it's just it's a problem for us because we're not used to newborn sleep, but it's quite normal for newborns to wake a lot. So by 4 to 6 months or 14 to 16, 14 to 21 weeks, that circadian rhythm's organized, their sleep starts to look like ours, self-soothing and self-regulating that we want them to have is now organizing. They can put their fingers in their mouth and suck on them. They're starting to roll for comfort. They're making that self-soothing sound. I'm not great at it, so y'all bear with me, but it's this fussing sound. It's like a squeaky door, but that actually calms them down. Every one of you made that sound as a baby. I'm going to tell you something. Tonight as you're going to sleep, close your eyes and make that sound that your baby's been making. You'll feel your nervous system slow down. Your baby is making that sound to self-soothe and slow themselves down so they can settle, become unconscious, and go to sleep. So that really comes together 14 to 21 weeks of age, right around 4 months. As the four-month sleep regression starts, now we start to see a lot of wake-ups that are basically babies saying, I don't know how to link up my sleep cycles, but I've got the goods in place to do it now. bingo, that's our time to start a real sleep method.
Perfect. So we've answered, when will my baby sleep through the night?
Which is covered a lot there.
No. And then our next question, which is like the right age to start, we're hearing around 4 to 6 months. And I want to revisit kind of your answer to that first question, because I just want to repeat this. So really, we're saying avoid BabyWise, avoid that book, avoid 12 hours in 12 weeks. They have been, in fact, they've even been called out, BabyWise, I know for sure was, by the AAP, saying don't follow this method. In fact, it can be damaging, very damaging for the baby.
We have seen failure to thrive, which essentially means that those babies now are forced to get all their caloric intake needs met in only 4 feeds in 12 hours of the day, not at night, by 3 months of age, folks. This is a 12-week-old, like a 12-week-old newborn. So what happens is that they start to lose weight because their bodies aren't prepared to do that. They start to lose weight. We've seen those babies lose a pound, and then their parents reach out saying, hey, what do we do? How do we course correct? And what we do is we let them feed again. And it's a total myth that you have to cut out feeds at night to sleep train effectively. We've been doing it for 25 years now, very effectively. It was, in fact, why I started to bridge the gap with the old sleep training paradigm, cut out night feed, sleep train. So no way. This transfer of milk is important at night. They need it for brain development. And frankly, moms that are nursing, if they just cut out milk cold turkey, they're going to have mastitis, like milk ducts, engorgement. They might lose their milk supply right at a time when their hormones are changing too. So we keep at least 1 or 2 feeds when we sleep train. And it's so effective. They're able to figure out how to link up sleep cycles, and they're getting the nourishment that they need. And frankly, the bonding time at night too.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned bonding, because it sort of relates to our next question. And a previous conversation we had with a child development practitioner, Rebecca Walsh, who was talking all about brain development and the importance of connection and the importance of really making sure that you're feeding on demand, in particular doing that during that newborn phase. It's important for the baby physically, but also mentally and socially and emotionally for their brains and their development. And so this next question I have for you is really related to, what is the best approach for feeding as it relates to feeding on demand and how that relates to sleep in those early days?
These are such great questions. I'm having so much fun. Okay. What we do first, before we start any sleep program, we track data. And I teach moms, with bottle feeding, it's a little bit more obvious because you can see how hungry baby is at night. You can see when they're hungriest versus just snacking at night. With nursing, it takes a little bit of getting to know the girls. So I'm a lactation educator, and I talk moms through paying attention to the quality of the feeding at night. And what'll happen is a newborn flutter sucks a lot, folks, because they get tired out nursing. By the time they're like 3, 4, 5 months of age, their transfer of milk really increases. For a lot of babies, they can get up to 1 ounce a minute, depending upon the time of day. So I ask moms to pay attention to the quality of feed first. Track some data for me. Is baby really hungry? Or are they sort of hungry, but after 2 minutes, they start to sleep? And what'll happen when they sleep on a feed at night is that they flutter suck. But if you had a light on, you'd see their cute little tongue moving quickly like a hummingbird inside the mouth behind the cheek there. And that means that they're like, this is a lovely cuddle. Hold me, but I'm not hungry. I just want to be with you. That gives us some good information. That tells us, hey, maybe we see that trend or that pattern 3, 4, 5 nights. Baby's letting us know, I'm not hungry at this time, but I'm hungry at these other times. So we'll keep the times that we've tracked that data for when baby's hungry, and we create these feed windows. They're about 2 hours long. So it gives us some intuitive feedback there where we know baby's hungry around 10 p.m. to midnight. So as soon as baby wakes up, don't sleep train, just feed your baby. We know that they're hungry at that time. Give them a good full feed, fill them up, put them down asleep. By the way, I'm a big fan of feeding back to sleep in the middle of the night. We still get great results with sleep training. But if they wake up an hour later, give them a quick burp and then do a little sleep training at that point. If they just had a good full feed, we know at that point they're not hungry. It's more about linking up their sleep cycles. So to answer your question, I always track data ahead of time to know what that little baby needs at night. And I get feedback from mom, especially nursing mom, so I know what's going on with her milk supply. Has she had a history of mastitis or plugged milk ducts? Because I don't want to just drop night feeds. That'll just add extra work for her if she has mastitis. We take it really slow so the baby's getting nourished. And then we've got the data, right? So now we know when they're hungry at night.
Yeah, and all of that is in the context of when a baby is ready to sleep train at that 4 to 6 month period, right? Because then prior to that, it really is all about making sure baby is healthy, physically their needs are met, as well as they're getting that need for connection. That's so important in that first year. So in other words, the feeding on demand is really applicable prior to sleep training. And then when you're saying when they're appropriately aged developmentally, physically, 4 to 6 months, then you can start introducing these windows. Do I have that right?
It's exactly right. And they are fairly intuitive based because we've tracked the data to understand where the hunger is at night. And we keep those feeds around the time when baby's shown us that they're hungry at night. We don't see a lot of crying when we sleep train because of it, because we're not asking a baby to just drop a night feed cold turkey as they're crying and sleep training. That would be a lot to ask that baby. That baby's showing us, hey, I'm still hungry at night. So I think it's a really smart way to minimize the crying. Crying is efficient. We're just using it to help them link up sleep cycles while keeping those feeds at night that are fairly intuitive in that feed window based on what the baby is showing us their hunger signs are at those times. So it actually, I would say, increases mom's confidence as well, because then now she can self-report. She'll say, oh my gosh, I'm realizing now I thought those were all feeds, but my baby's just flutter sucking a lot at night. It's a nice cuddle, but I'm ready to get more sleep. I can see my baby's not hungry at those times. I'm ready to drop some of those more, what we'll call non-nutritive, more pacifying feeds, and then keep one or two feeds at night that are good, hearty, full feeds.
Yeah, I appreciate the data-driven approach there. So once they hit the age where they can start sleep training, you're starting off with, let's gather data, let's see what's correct and unique for your baby, not just according to some schedule that may or may not apply to your baby and your situation.
That's right. There's a mom I'm working with right now, and she has low milk supply, and she's working really hard to keep her milk supply up. So we're keeping 3 feeds at night. She wants to keep the 3 feeds. The baby's interested in the 3 feeds. We're looking at weight gain, but we've been able to successfully do some sleep training around those 3 feed times at night. So it's a win-win.
Yeah. And so what about the next question we have? Can my baby sleep in my bed with me?
Oh, these are good ones. This is such a great question because, again, back to the research. The research shows, I mean, this is so fascinating. Up to 80% of American families are going to bed share in the first 3 years, which tells us a lot of us are doing it. So you got this on the left hand, bed sharing. That's the reality of life. We're tired, we're working, it's 4 in the morning, we're bed sharing. The American Academy of Pediatrics, who does good work, they're saying no bed sharing. They will get behind room sharing, because the research is really clear. McKenna's research, he's that anthropologist that's doing bed sharing sleep labs. How cool is that, folks? And they're finding in that science that the baby's heart rate and breathing regulates when they're close to the parent. And it's important enough research, everybody, that the American Academy of Pediatrics in the last, I think it was 5 or 6 years, maybe 7, they updated their policy guidelines to room share at least 6 months up to 12 months. Because the research is so clear out of McKenna's labs that the bed sharing is a contributor regulating heart rate and breathing.
So there's a clear benefit.
There is a clear benefit. So the way that I approach this question, because I also look at SIDS research, and I've sat with families that have lost their babies to SIDS. And what happened when the AAP came out, I mean, it's heartbreaking. What happened when the AAP said no bed sharing, you know what parents did? They started to sleep with babies on sofas and recliners. They said, okay, well, we're not going to bed share. And I know this is a scary topic, folks, but I really don't leave anything off the table because I think education of information is empowerment as a parent. It builds our confidence. Parents started to sleep in recliners on sofas with their littles, with their newborns. So the take home here is there are some great new products on the market that are facilitating safe co-sleeping and bed sharing, meaning that you can move these bassinets or arms reach co-sleepers, or like Harvey Karp Snoo is a product out there. What's happened over the last few years is that they've started to create products that allow for babies to be in the family bed, but with some containment, right? I hear so many parents now saying, I want to bed share with my baby or room share with my baby, but I want to safely do it. I mean, look at that. How much has changed? We were putting newborns in cribs the first day they were born in another room. That was 25 years ago. And it's really shifted. So I would say if you're going to bed share, a good way to do it is to have a safe sleep spot for your little one. Kathleen Kendall Tackett has great research, and I'll include this in the show notes, the follow-up, so y'all have a link to this, because it's such a great one sheet that has guidelines for safe bed sharing and the do's and the don'ts. I think she's done a good job. She's a really big lactation advocate and bed sharing advocate, and she's saying, hey, we acknowledge in the data that a lot of families are bed sharing. We know the AAP's recommendations. Why don't we come up with safe bed sharing for the folks that are going to do it? Because we know it's going to happen. At least it gives them some guardrails for how to do it safely. And then, of course, there's like the rule outs, like no pets in the bed, no kids, no heavy linens, all that kind of good stuff that we know, no smoking, no drinking, no drug use. And she's put that together. We'll include it for everybody so you'll have it. And then if you're on the fence and not sure, I can't recommend enough room sharing. The SIDS risk is highest between months 2 to 4. 2 to 4 months of age, the SIDS risk is the highest. There's a lot happening in their breathing and heart rate development, brain development. And so if there was ever a time, I can't say this enough, I think room sharing is really important, at least the first 4 to 6 months. And then at that point, I would ask parents to do a little check-in. Is the room sharing working? Is it not working? And then by 6 months, is that SIDS risk is really coming down to practically zero? I would say a lot of families work on moving a baby to more independent sleeping. And then there, the baby's getting their sleep, the parents are getting their sleep. But I would say I would really emphasize and encourage at least the first 4 to 6 months of keeping that baby close by.
Yeah. Oh, and it's so wonderful and easy to get your rest if you're side-lying nursing. It's so lovely because even if you're not actually sleeping, your body can lay down and rest. And that's something that's very lovely to do, especially when you're exhausted in those early days.
It's wonderful. And it's a great way to nurse, it turns out, if you have oversupply, which I did. So it became one of the only ways to nurse successfully. It slowed down my milk supply. So there could be a lot of positive reasons for it, but we'll include that good information for your folks so they're really well informed.
Yeah, thank you. So our next question is perfect to go next because you mentioned it. There are some very high price items out there around sleep technologies. And I wanted to ask and call out the Snoo in particular and other devices like that that are so popular right now. Are those worth it? Do we have to spend the money in order to get good sleep?
I think that this is, again, an individual family kind of thing. The great thing about this Snoo product that we're talking about is that you can rent it now. So the Snoo, everybody, is a tech-enabled sleep bassinet for a newborn. Tech-enabled means that it has levels of vibration, movement, white noise, and it also has, which I think is probably the most important feature. I'm less interested in the movement and the white noise and the lights on it. I think the most important feature is that it has a built-in swaddle. So it effectively keeps the baby swaddled, which I'm a big fan of. Fourth trimester swaddling, babies really benefit from it, helps mute that startle reflex that they have as newborns. So the Snoo did a smart thing. They built the swaddle into the Snoo. So it does keep, everything's bundled together. I think the price point, I'm like almost embarrassed that I don't want to pitch it. I think it's like $1,500.
It's not cheap.
I've never seen any product in the baby field that's that price point. But again, we're going back to safe sleep for newborns and parents getting their needed sleep. And, you know, for a family, that might be a great investment. I would recommend everybody rent it first, because about half the babies in my practice were SNU fails. Parents bought it, their baby didn't like it. So there's some great benefits to it, but it's not for every baby. And it's an expensive investment for a baby that doesn't like it. You won't know until you get it. So I would recommend renting it. And then it's a better way to find out, to trial it and see. You want to move your baby out of these products pretty quickly. By the time they're 3, 4, 5 months, they've aged out of it.
Why is that so important?
Because two reasons. They're made for newborns. They're not made for babies that are moving. Newborns don't move much. But by 3, 4, 5 months of age, as they go from newborn to baby stage, they want to move in their sleep. And frankly, we want to encourage it. That's part of healthy development, is to not thwart their movement. Turns out it's good for babies to move. They're going to move into their preferred sleep position, much like us. Flat on back is not, it's a safe sleep position, but it's not a preferred sleep position for a baby. We ask parents to do it because of SIDS risk. But as soon as a baby can, they want to move to side or tummy, or they want to ball up, because that is a secure sleep position for that baby. They feel comfortable in that position. And the SNU is not intended for that baby that's now moving. We see a lot of babies by 3 to 4 months, they're ready to come out of the SNU. But I can relate to this as a mom. Parents are keeping them in the SNU far longer than they should be because they're scared. The SNU has been so helpful with helping their newborn sleep, and they're afraid about the next stage of sleep, which is more movement. But you want to get them out of there. It's not safe. Once they're starting to move and roll around during tummy time, once they're starting to kick, flip a leg, they have to come out of these bassinet sleep, you know, devices for newborns. And now they need to be in a mini crib or a full crib or pack and play, soft-sided or hard-sided. But that is really the next stage. And there's sleep architecture and there's sleep movement, and they're going to do a lot of movement as they're sleeping. And that's a great thing, everybody.
Yeah. So it sounds like they can be worth it. For some families, they work. For some families, they don't. We have no affiliation with that brand. We're just talking about that brand in particular because it's well known. But there are other devices that are kind of similar too. So it's kind of, we're just talking about the technology at this point. And weren't you telling me something once in a prior conversation around how sometimes it can be hard for the baby to transition out of that? So while it might be helpful for the few months, can almost be too helpful in a way, because it is such a change versus being in like a regular bed.
Thank you for reminding me about that. It's so important to share that with parents. So it's called habituation. It just basically means that the SNU, because of the tech involved with the SNU, where it vibrates at varying levels, babies get used to that. It's similar to this, putting, like 20 years ago, babies would go like in a swing at night and they would swing sleep. The SNU, the tech behind it is that they have varying levels of this stimulation or vibration. The babies habituate to that. They did include a weaning feature on the SNU that essentially means that it's very low level of stimulation or vibration. So the baby's losing the habituation. But we have found that those, not all of them, but those babies tend to take longer to sleep train. I think that it means that the habituation is really happening with that product. And I reached out to Harvey Karp about it. He said, just use the weaning feature. I'm like, it doesn't work for all babies. It's a real thing that the habituation happens. And it's something I do design these products and bring them to market. And it's a very real aspect of this, is habituation, that the baby does habituate or get used to the thing that's helping them sleep. And they have to transition out of that. And so they may do more crying when sleep train, or do more crying coming out of it. Not all of them, but a handful of them do.
Yeah. So there's pros and cons there. We're not, I think, leaning pretty heavily one way or the other. It's, again, what I appreciate you, Angelique, so much, is that you talk about what's right for specific families, because it totally varies. Every baby is different. I appreciate the feedback there, because I don't want someone to be out there thinking, oh, if I can't afford this one thing, then I'm not going to sleep, or I'm somehow not meeting the needs for my family. Like, absolutely not, is what I'm hearing.
Sure. I would say if you've started to sleep in a recliner or sofa with your baby out of sheer exhaustion, you're going to do a hard stop and you're going to revisit the sleep location and work on some sleep method or sleep changes. And again, it just happens because we're so tired as parents. I mean, it really is just survival. So some of what I'm sharing with you today is about just taking a look at your unique situation with your newborn or baby. We briefly mentioned it, talked about it, but I do have a no low cry method that is great for newborns. We're talking about, we answer the question about when to start sleep training, but folks, I do have a no low cry method that's for babies. It's very effective. If you don't want a sleep trainer, your baby's too young to do it, use my no low cry method. And it's an effective way to help them start to sleep off your body or transition out of the snoo or a bassinet or swing.
Okay. Yes. And again, we do have an episode that's dedicated to talking about that as a deep dive. So go check that one out. Hi, listeners. I have some exciting news to share with you today. We've partnered with Every Mother, your go-to destination for evidence-based exercise therapy regimens. Whether you're dealing with diastasis recti, preparing for birth, or navigating postpartum recovery, Every Mother has your back. With personalized daily routines tailored to your core and pelvic floor needs, they're here to support you every step of the way. Say hello to a stronger, healthier you with Every Mother. Visit their website today and use code 4thTrimester10 for 10% off your personalized regimen. That's fourth spelled out, F-O-U-R-T-H, trimester10 for 10% off, because every mother deserves the very best. So you mentioned swaddling. Let's talk about that. Like, do people have to swaddle their baby?
So swaddling came about, I would say it was probably 2-3 decades ago when the AAP came out and said, everybody back asleep for newborns. Back to sleep is the safest position for newborns. And that's stayed pretty current, even with all the research they've done to shoot holes in it. They're like, oh yeah, it still is the safest position for newborns to sleep. So they had to come up with a way to help newborns sleep on their backs because it's not a natural position to sleep. And it's actually a very vulnerable position. And, you know, for us, we're in fetal tuck. And if you look at ultrasound images, even a little tiny sweet pea, you know, at 12 weeks in utero, they're in fetal tuck position like this. It's so amazing. It is such a natural position. So what they did is the swaddle came out of that development with Back to Sleep campaign, that we needed a position to put babies in a cocoon. And the take home is that not all babies like swaddling. However, I think half of it is that, especially for first time parents, swaddling is tricky. Now, there are again, going back to products, there are enough companies out there that have created swaddles that take the guesswork. But using, a blanket, a muslin blanket, it takes a little bit of origami. Some parents are great at that, some parents aren't. But there are now like swaddle bundles, swaddle blankets that kind of Velcro and close up. So it does take the guesswork out. Here's a good take home. Is your baby's startle reflex? All newborns have a startle reflex. That's where they kind of shake violently. Like when you set them down for diaper change or you put them down for tummy time and their arms kind of pop out and then shake.
And they can do that when they're sleeping too.
They do it in their sleep and they'll wake themselves up. So if you have that newborn, mine was like that, that startled awake and they were in a really good deep sleep, they're going to be a great candidate for a swaddle. Because what that does is it mutes the startle reflex so it doesn't wake them up. It keeps them in that fetal tuck cocoon that their little bodies really like.
And what about the arms?
Yes. So I developed, it's no longer on the market. We decided not to be manufacturers of baby products because that's a lot of work. That's a whole other conversation. But I did bring to market 15 years ago an arms up swaddle. And I'm thrilled to see so many companies borrowed my idea and made it theirs. Because it's how it works with these things. Babies, look at them in the womb. Their hands are up close to their face. And there are swaddle products out there. That's called the fetal tuck position. It's a natural reflex for security and relaxation. And there's swaddle products out there that swaddle babies' hands at their hips.
Or even I've seen like hands are like out or up, like above their heads even, or like on either side, like they're flying.
So you're going to have to just determine your baby's startle reflex. I would recommend against swaddling hands down.
Like by their hips.
By their hips, because what it does is it creates a lot of tension or tightness around the hips. And babies they're inclined to have hip dysplasia if their hips are swaddled too tightly. So you really want to have, it's having the hands swaddled, but the hips open is really the take home for swaddling.
So their hands kind of ideally would be kind of up around their chest.
Midline center here. And then you have these zip up bags that will put babies, we call it the football position. And those work great too. If a baby has a strong startle reflex, they don't work that great because they'll startle right through that thin fabric. So there's a lot of products out there. And again, it's just really looking at your baby to see what your baby needs and then experimenting a little bit. You'll know if a swaddle is working because it really, you'll see this, they're peaceful and their body just sleeps and they're still. They don't have to work so hard to sleep. I want to say one more thing about that, which is that if you imagine like there was a time when babies stayed right on our bodies day and night, and time not so long ago. So the startle reflex wasn't a thing because our bodies were right there to meet their bodies and give them that security.
Well, and I think we still see a lot of people, you know, swaddling to the body. So they're staying and they're sleeping. I mean, I just personally loved that experience of having my newborn sleep on my chest. You know, there's all kinds of very safe blankets and wraps and
baby carriers,
you know, sleep carriers.
That's right.
Yeah, where they can just cuddle up. And of course, my babies did that. They would tuck their hands kind of around their face or around their chest.
That's right.
It's pretty typical. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I appreciate that commentary because it's very common. I mean, what would women do if you've got to get up and walk around and you're not going to necessarily
put your baby strapped?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That feels very natural. Okay. So another question. So what if someone comes to you and they say, well, we sleep trained, maybe the baby's, you know, say 7 months, 8 months, we sleep trained, but now my baby's waking up again quite a bit at night, more than we have scheduled. So help, what do we do?
So the sleep books have us believe that we sleep train and we will never hear from our baby at night. These, you know, the same sleep programs that say 7 to 7, 12 hours at night. As if, you know, the baby's developing brain is dynamic and they're supposed to regress. That is the nature, the biology of brain development in the baby and the toddler. And so the take home is really, again, debunking this old paradigm that you'll never hear from them again at night once you sleep train. And that somehow that's a reflection on good parenting and a good baby and good sleep. And I'm asking parents to move into a new paradigm, which is that regressions are not a sign of failure. They're a very normal and expected part of your baby and toddler's development, the arc of their development. But the way that humans develop is through an attachment relationship, meaning that as their brain goes through rapid periods of organization and new skill set building, their behavior regresses. Because at the basis of that is attachment, which I think a better word for that is just simply, it's going to sound woo-woo, but it's love. It's connection. It's bonding. We're all looking for it, folks. Can you imagine? So is your little one. And so as their brain goes through a rapid period of development, their sleep is going to regress because it's your baby's way of saying, hey, or your toddler, hey, I'm changing, but are you still there for me? Are we still connected? This is the foundational piece. It's not a failure on your part as a parent. It's not a failure on the baby or toddler's part at all. They're looking for connection again. And then, of course, you move in closer. We call this responsive parenting, which is following your intuition, offering more help. Perhaps they're getting teeth. Perhaps they're in a growth spurt. Perhaps they're in a developmental phase where they're organizing new skill sets like learning to crawl. Or starting to understand object permanence, which means that they exist separate from you now. And all of that, it's not like it just stops at bedtime. It is still organizing through the night. So it's really bringing in this new understanding of brain development these the first years, which and connection, love, attachment security, regressions, that all that's good stuff. And it's really empowering parents, like letting them know this is what we do during a regression, which is follow your intuition more. That good intuition stuff. If your baby's waking up at night crying at a time when they normally would sleep, that means something's changing for them and they need you. And we can track these developmental phases every 6 weeks or so through the first year, where they're going to be more hungry at night, waking up for 1 or 2 hours wide awake, a little clingy, they don't want to be put down. They just need more of you. It could last a night, could last a couple of nights or a week or two, maybe they're sick too. And then their brain organizes, the skill set's organized, and then it goes away.
Yes. And these are phases, right? You know, I think that's the other thing to remember. It can be hard in the moment, but you can get through it because it is temporary. It's for sure temporary. I really liked an app called the Wonder Weeks because that worked really well. I enjoyed that app because it could track visually on a calendar when these regressions typically happened and then also provide information about what was happening in the brain during that time. I thought it was so cool.
That's right. I include the Wonder Weeks. I mean, that book's just exploded. The approach has exploded. 20 years ago, that book was in Dutch, like a photocopied manuscript on Amazon. That's how far this whole field has shifted, where we're like, their brains are changing?
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously.
That's what's causing them to wake up? So we definitely include the Wonder Weeks work. And I have a sharp focus on sleep. So we're able to just know specifically that at 33 weeks, we are going to see this regression occur. And 95% of the time we do.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's so fascinating. Yeah. I liked the app quite a bit. I thought that was helpful. It would alert me and remind me, oh, by the way, this is coming up. So it kind of helped me in the expectations that I was going to have for my upcoming week. Maybe that's not the best week to do a weekend away or something like that.
Or sleep train, everybody. That if you notice that your baby is trying to crawl, if you're on the Wonder Weeks app, or if your baby's just wide awake at night, you feed them. Like back to the 7-month-old example, you feed them at night and they don't fall back to sleep. That means that they're in a big period of brain development.
Got it. Yeah.
They're not a bad sleeper. They're like, I'm just working on new skill sets. Can I get a break? Someone just hold me. It's coincidentally not the best time to sleep train. We will attempt it sometimes if I can track the babies coming out of it. But if they're in the thick of it, we wait for a couple days to a week so their brain cools off. The skill sets organize, and then we work on sleep training because then it just goes so much better.
Right. It's too many different things at once.
That's right. So it's just such a new way to think about sleep and development and babies and feeding at night, that, you know, that there's like this dynamic range of variables that we look at.
Yeah, for sure. I like what you said about secure emotional attachment and love as it relates to brain development and connection. That doesn't sound woo-woo to me at all. It's reinforced 100% in the episode we had with Rebecca Walsh, which is Wire Your Baby for Success. It's all about brain development. And it's also, there's a great book I've read called Hold Me Tight. It's actually for adults, but it's all about the fundamental need for love and attachment that we have as adults and in our adult relationships. It was written by a therapist, a couples counselor. And it was like, wait, I'm seeing all these patterns, all these adults coming to me and they're blaming each other or they're withdrawing or they're just kind of increasingly trying to agitate the other person into action. And all of these things at the core of it, she realized, was like, my adults here, my couples, they just want love and attachment and security emotionally. That's it. They want connection. So yeah, it's true. It's true for humans, regardless of age.
Yes, it is. I have a method that I teach for toddlers that would be a great future podcast, FYI. And I'll just briefly describe it, because the old sleep method for toddlers was, they're manipulating you, they're being naughty, lock them in the room, they'll eventually cry themselves out and fall asleep.
That's so sad. That's not true, by the way, people. None of that is true. They're trying to communicate and connect with you.
It's probably how a lot of us learn how to sleep, by the way, if I really take it to that level. Yeah. And as a therapist that, you know, my research is looking at attachment in sleep locations and feeding method and mood disorders. But I really was so interested 25, 30 years ago in that attachment security and how all of those variables work together. So I developed the sleep method for toddlers, and I use a big toolbox of methods, everybody, because it cannot be one size fits all. The sleep training method that works for babies, they age out of it by around 8 months to 18 months of age. And sleep training does not work any longer. It'll actually worsen their sleep and lead to sleep anxiety. So the method I developed for toddlers comes straight out of my work as a play therapist for kiddos, where I use play and art and nature to help them with big feels or traumas or transitions. And what I did is I took those play therapy, storytelling, and I teach those to parents to prepare the toddler for the sleep change. We just don't have them start a method. They're like us. They do better with a change in their life if they know about it ahead of time and they can prepare for it. And 50% of the toddlers will start to sleep better just from doing the play therapies and the storytelling, because the script inherent to that is about separating and saying bye-bye to their parents at sleep time or their parent at sleep time. So it gets their little body. I mean, talk about attachment, security, and love being the basis, right? It gets those toddlers ready, their little bodies ready to say bye-bye. And I feel like that's a real skill set, in particular for toddlers that are trying to figure out their bye-byes and feel safe about it. I say to parents that are embarking on toddler sleep changes and about to use my two-phase approach for toddlers, I say, you know, the skill set they're going to learn through the sleep method we do together is a skill set for life. We're teaching them to feel safe to separate from you at sleep time, that they don't have to be full of terror and panic and fear, but they can feel safe in their little bodies and use the feeling of you as a resource. And it's going to set them up as adults for feeling safe when they separate from a loved one. Oh, gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, that's a life skill.
It's all connected.
Yes, it's absolutely setting people up for success later in life. So let's bookmark that. We will definitely revisit toddler sleep in a future episode. I love that. Okay, fantastic. And then, so I think that relates to this next question a little bit, and you kind of jotted this one down so you can give us more context on it, but it's around, and we talked about it too. So someone would come to you and say, we sleep trained, but how do I know when my baby really needs me? So what's that about?
So going back to a description I just gave, what will happen with sleep training is that within a couple of nights to a week, you get a baseline sleep pattern.
So this is, say, like a five-month-old baby or something like that.
That's it. At 5 months, you sleep train. I like the interval method, folks. And then I keep one or two feeds at night with my five-month-olds because I don't want to deprive of nutrition, especially if I'm working with a nursing mom. I don't want her to have a big issue, especially if she's going back to work. We want to keep her milk supply good. Bottle feeding, we can track a little bit more closely, but I'll keep one or two feeds for that 5 month old. Then let's say it's 7 months. They're learning to crawl or get to all fours. They're going through one of the wonder weeks or developmental phases that we track. And now what starts to happen, the baseline sleep, which is, we're going to call that the straight line sleep, where it's predictable. They just sleep, you sleep, and it's like a predictable sleep pattern. What's going to happen is that the sleep is going to regress. The straight line goes away. Now there's dips. They start to wake up. They start to wake up at times of the night when they normally would sleep. And you're going to know this as a parent because you will have gotten used to the baseline sleep because it allows you to sleep and there's some peace and predictability with the family sleep. Yay, we love that. So you're going to know when your baby's waking up at times when they would normally sleep, you're going to say, this doesn't feel right. My baby normally is just sleeping pretty peacefully at 1 a.m, but this is not what they normally do. Now they're waking, they're crying, they're very upset. You're going to follow your intuition, which is like the most important thing as a parent, because we've never done this before. We're like newbies, and your parenting intuition is going to tell you this doesn't feel right. And you go, this is the responsive parenting that we practice, right? Which is to go in and check. And then you're going to go through your list, which is, could be a growth spurt, could be baby getting sick, could be some teething, could be they got shots that day, could be that they're learning to crawl and their leg got stuck between a crib slat, any number of things. And then that intuition scale, you're going to respond accordingly and comfort your baby. You're going to have 2 to 4 of those in the first year, at least. So count on it. And again, it's not a reflection on a failure in parenting or poorly sleeping baby. It's a normal part of the sleep organization and consolidation the first few years that they're going to have baseline sleep regressions, baseline sleep regressions. Now, some outliers there that I see in my practice are little ones with eczema, sleep apnea. So eczema in particular for a long, it's so silly this stuff. For a long time, we were, you know, told to tell parents, well, eczema doesn't affect a baby's sleep. Can you imagine like having a flare up and then like it doesn't affect your sleep? I mean, we know this if we have a rash or mosquito bite, we sleep restlessly.
Of course. Yeah. Just because the baby can't use words to say, my skin is in agony, it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt them.
Oozing and scabbed. We, of course, there's finally a scientific study, though we knew this as parents, but it says, oh, by the way, eczema affects babies and toddlers' sleep. They're going to have way more sleep regressions because of their flare-ups. And they're going to habituate to itching. Even when they don't have a flare-up, they just scratch themselves for self-regulation. So they're going to have more regressions. Babies with, or toddlers with sleep apnea, which can, we can do a sleep study for that. I see greater likelihood babies that have a history of reflux, food allergies, environmental allergies, respiratory, frequent respiratory infections, frequent ear infections. They're going to have many more sleep regressions than their peers. And that is not a failure on a parent's part. And you can still do a method successfully, but it means you're probably going to have double the regressions in a year. I still think it's worth it to do a sleep method because the 2 to 3 months that they're not sick or not having a flare up, that sleep is so beneficial to the family.
Oh, for sure. Yep. 100% agreed. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Our next question is about a sleep training study that was about increased cortisol after sleep training. Can we talk about that one?
I'm so glad you're bringing this up, Sarah. Great questions. Okay, so this one gets a lot of play on social media, blog posts, podcasts, because it's such a like an attention grabber. It's like just one of those like titles that just grabs parents. And it goes to the heart of our terror about harming our little ones, doing something that's going to harm them, you know? And sleep training in particular, it's been a controversial parenting issue, parenting topic. Shouldn't be. And so that's a whole other topic for another day about the controversy of it. But this attention-grabbing scientific study, this headline, you'll see it, you know, referred to in podcasts and social media that sleep training increases cortisol levels in babies. I mean, think about that as a parent, right?
Right. I mean, why would anyone ever do that? That sounds terrible.
It's just makes it, and if we've done it, we feel terrible. You know, if we use a sleep training method, we now are second guessing ourselves and then of course second guessing our desires to have our baby sleep well and get sleep ourselves, which, you know, here we are after like our family's health and well-being and self-care. So, you know me, I love my science, Sarah, and I really do. I just spent 25 years looking at the science around pediatric sleep, the 50 years of really fascinating pediatric sleep studies and sleep science. You go to this study, how was the study set up? It's actually heartbreaking to me that the ethics committee signed off on this. They did this sleep training method, probably extinction method, which is where you put a baby down and you don't come back until the morning. They did it in a hospital with a strange nurse that the baby had never met, taking the baby from the parent.
At what age, how old baby are we talking about?
These were babies that were in the 7, 8, 9, 10 month range, which is when separation anxiety and stranger anxiety is starting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the fact that they signed off on that, like if you just sit with that, like heart crushing.
Yeah.
And of course the cortisol levels would go up. So they tracked that the mom's cortisol level went up, which mine would go up. If somebody took my baby from me to do a study where they let them cry alone in a hospital room.
Without eating?
Without eating.
Yeah.
And using extinction method without, so the environment's not familiar. The nurse just takes that. I mean, it feels like it's 1940.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. That doesn't seem ethical.
There's no ethics to that. this happens in science where they set up studies to get the desired outcome. There's like a bias that they're looking to get reinforced with, and they know the outcome they're going to get. And that's the outcome they got. They found that the cortisol levels went up and stayed sustained. Even as the moms came down, the babies stayed high and sustained high. They continue to stay high.
It's really, really sad. What I'm thinking actually is that it seems like this is coming down to sort of some fundamental language and definition issue as well, which is that, you know, people will ask, is sleep training safe? Because sleep training, the phrase, is so closely connected with, like, you know, the extinction method. Like, people think sleep training means you shut the door, you don't interact with your baby, even if, like, they're like obviously very distressed for, you know, 12 hours. And so I think that's it. It's sort of like, maybe we need to revisit also, like, what does sleep training mean? It doesn't necessarily mean that. Sleep training can be safe and can be loving and can be developmentally appropriate depending on the methodology. And that's kind of like a wrapper around this whole conversation a little bit, because it seems like a study like that, the way you're describing it, they're just saying, oh, sleep training stresses out the baby, stresses out the family. Well, yeah, if you're talking about the extinction method, of course.
That's right. That's right. When we do sleep training, it's in the familiar environment, the baby's home, the room where that baby's sleeping. It's parents checking on the baby, people that baby's familiar with. We keep 1 to 2 feeds at night at least. We don't do it during a period of development where we know the baby's going to be insecure or rapidly organizing new skills. We track all of that data with the Millette method. So we find that sweet spot where the baby's going to sleep train, the crying is minimal, and there's not deficits. We also only do nights. We don't even do naps. We just work on the night so that baby can master that quickly. The crying is efficient, it's short, and it goes away quickly. To your point, there's a really smart way to do sleep training, that old outdated extinction or 12 hours at night or no feeding. We can take that and say, hey, there's a better way to do this where we modify it and bring some changes to sleep training so it supports that baby.
Yes. Love that. So, final question then. We've debunked so much. I'm really enjoying this conversation, but we're finally getting to the end of our list. And so this last question is very specific. It's about pacifier use. So can my baby use a pacifier when sleep training?
Great question. So science and the recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends pacifiers because they have found that that sucking, which is really interesting because it's really just nursing. But for a parent that wants to put a baby down, have them sucking, the pacifier can keep them in a more alert, a quiet alert sleep state. And their belief is that that reduces the likelihood of SIDS. So we're seeing a lot more pacifiers. You can't force the baby to take it. So parents know this. They're either going to take it or they're not going to take it. What we start to look at is the pacifier a help or a hindrance with helping a baby to consolidate and organize their sleep cycles at night? And the simplest way to know that, parents, is are you having to reinsert the pacifier several times through the night? Are you having to get up and reinsert it to get a baby to link up a sleep cycle? And remember, the sleep cycles are 90 minutes to 2 hours. So if you're having to get up at that cadence to reinsert a pacifier to get through the next sleep cycle, it's probably that the pacifier is now hindering your baby's ability to link up the sleep cycle. You're the one that's linking it up versus your baby using self-soothing to link up the sleep cycle. So the take-home is pacifiers can be super beneficial. But if you're that parent, and as I'm talking about that pattern, if you went, oh yeah, that's us. I was up 4 times last night, plugging it back in. I'm going to recommend that you check out a sleep training method called the interval method. If your baby's 4 to 6 months, if you're comfortable with a little bit of crying, interval method, like I said, I keep 1 to 2 feeds at night. It is a great method. They don't have a secure attachment to the pacifier until they're close to the first birthday. By the first birthday, now it is their security object. But it's really easy to get rid of a pacifier when they're 4, 6, 8 months of age. It's not a secure object yet. And we can do it very effectively. What you're going to see your baby do is self-soothe in other ways. It's all wired in them to do that. And they'll stop themselves from crying. They won't use a pacifier. Say, oh my gosh, I thought they were so addicted to it. actually that a lot of the times it's the parent that is.
Yeah.
And just by using that interval method, it takes 3 to 7 nights. They don't need it anymore. Now they're linking up their sleep cycles themselves.
So a pacifier is not necessary by any stretch.
Not at all.
Yeah. And don't try to force your baby to use a pacifier, please.
That's right. They'll just spit it out. They won't use
it. Well, and I think in past conversations too, we've talked about this. There's like a certain age when they can grasp it themselves and put it in. If they're doing that, then obviously they want it. But for a long time, they don't even have that ability.
They don't. That's called a pincher grasp. You're right. And they don't really have it till 7, 8, 9 months of age. And pincher grasp is when they can pick up their puffs and feed themselves. And they use that same pincher grasp to grab a pacifier and reinsert it. So again, they don't have the object permanence in place yet to have the secure attachment to the pacifier. So there's quite a bit of wiggle room starting by 4 to 6 months of age, where they'll use their self-soothing to connect up their sleep cycles. They really can do it.
Well, great. Well, that concludes our top 10 sleep training questions and answers. Thank you so much, Angelique.
Thank you, Sarah. It was great to see you again. And you can see the passion. I love this topic. And yeah, thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, no, I learned so much in this conversation. I'm sure our listeners did too. For those listeners who are interested in going deeper, like we've said several times, there are other episodes we've recorded with Angelique that we highly recommend. So check those out. Angelique also has on her website webinars on demand. So you can go to her website, which is angeliquemillette.com, and we'll put a link to her site and you can get more information on demand. You can also book her for, as she mentioned, a free 15-minute consult. And then also you can get a discount on her 60-minute consult package, plus all those on-demand webinars, if you use the code 4THTRY. So the number 4THTRI10, 4THTRY10. We'll write that down. But that way you're getting a little bit of a discount if you want to go and book some one-on-one time for your specific sleep needs for your family with Dr. Angelique Millette. So thanks again, Dr. Millette, and we'll see you next time on the 4THTRIMESTER podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast in order to hear more from us. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I hope you'll join us next time on the 4THTRIMESTER. The theme music on this podcast was created by Sean Trott. Hear more at soundcloud.com/Sean Trott. Special thanks to my true loves, my husband Ben, daughter Penelope, and baby girl Evelyn. Don't forget to share the 4THTRIMESTER podcast with any new and expecting parents. I'm Sarah Trott. Goodbye for now.
Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I'll sing a song for you. You got your wheels, you got your gears. You ride around town without any fear. You got your pedals, you got your brakes. You always wear your helmet for safety's sake. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing the best that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you.